Again, a study of the books of 1st and 2nd Peter. I was given a choice as to what to do. And it was about the only way I could really schedule this in. To do something that is familiar, but at the same time something that I enjoy doing about as well as anything in preaching the gospel, and that is studying these two books. Most of us, I guess, have what we consider our sugar sticks, the things that we really appreciate and feel that we have pursued more than others. And I must say that for myself, the context of these two books is such. I am personally thrilled by the things I find in 1st and 2nd Peter, and I am shaken by the things I read and disturbed by the things I read, because they strike me in a way that is very different than I experience on an everyday basis here in the United States. We live in a tremendously affluent age. I don't know, but I think it is probably correct to say, I'm going to hedge myself on that, that this is the most affluent period in the history of the United States. I mean, today. Now you think about that. We live in, I think, unquestionably the most affluent society in the entire world today. We have very few needs, and we have very few wants, and I mean in that sense of things that we ought to have that we don't, or necessities that would keep us going that are lacking in our lives. We're living on surpluses. That apparently has become true, at least in the figment of the government's imagination, with regard to our availability of money to run this government. It's true with almost every state in the United States. There are surpluses, and they're trying to figure out, shall we give the people back their money, or shall we use it to give to them in some other way? It's just an unparalleled circumstance and situation that exists. I want you to be well aware of the fact, and I'm sure you are, that things are not this way all over the world. There are Christians this morning who are starving to death. There are Christians today who are dying for the cause of Christ. There are Christians today, if they are not being put to death, are being severely beaten and mistreated. They're losing their jobs. Their families are being harassed. Their property is being taken away from them for no other reason than the fact that they're Christians. I am not so naive as to think that one of these days it may be this way in the United States. I am not speaking pessimistically there. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I'm not the son of a prophet. I have no idea as to what the future holds in this country. I know one thing, our morals have collapsed. And whether our economy is a veneer that is simply covering over a cracked superstructure, I don't know. And it's not my job to know. I want us to understand that if we don't grasp the perspective of 1 Peter in respect to our individual lives, we will never understand what it means to be a Christian. We may call ourselves Christians. Other people may refer to us as Christians, but we will never know what it means to be a Christian until we understand the perspective and until we view life from the perspective of the book of 1 Peter especially. Let me say one other thing in general before I get to the lesson specifically. It is true that the lessons are not as they will be presented, but it'll be a simple enough matter to change this. When I sent the list of lessons, I only knew the number that I was going to present. I really didn't know the times or the arrangements as far as the individual services were concerned. And so basically, I just sent a list 1 through 10. Now, if you will take the AM lessons and the PM lessons, and you will alternate these lessons. In other words, the first AM and the first PM, the second AM and the second PM, right down through the list, then that's the way I'm going to present them, in a kind of chronological order as they appear throughout the books of 1st and 2nd Peter. And with that simple change, you should be able to follow through on this quite easily. Let's read a couple of texts together. Turn with me to 1st Peter chapter 1 and verse 2. And while you're doing that, I'll hold up one of my transparencies. So. The world has run off and left Sewell and me. The fortunate thing for Sewell is he has a bunch of technicians in the congregation, and I don't. I have been accused of a terribly bad thing. I've had some people accuse me of fleecing the flock. That's a roundabout way of saying that I wasn't worth my salt, that my preaching was no good, and that I shouldn't even be paid for it. But I want to tell you what, it's bad enough to be like that. It's worse to be a sheep stealer. You know, try and build a congregation from other congregations around in the community. But Sewell made an accusation against me that's very serious. It's the first time in my life I've ever been accused of this, and that is a shepherd stealer. Two of your former elders are now elders in the congregation where I preach. And I'm here recruiting two more. I just want you to... I want you to be aware of the fact that the Crystal River, Florida, is a colony of Atlanta, and particularly of Embry Hills. And so if you have any interest in that direction, please let me know. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, and my understanding is that the Pew Bibles are the New King James, and I will try as best I can to follow through on the major passages in the New King James Version. I won't make any bones about it. I am basically going to be using the American Standard Version. It is not my version of choice. My version of choice is the King James Version. But years ago, I started teaching, and the version of choice at the school was the American Standard Version, and I was forced into using it. And for about 40 years, I wrote my notes in the margin of this American Standard Version. I've been using the same one since 1952. So if it's ever destroyed, I will quit preaching. That's the reason I'm using the American Standard Version, is because all my wisdom is in the margins and not in my head. But read with me, if you will, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, and then we're going to turn over to chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the pilgrims scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, in sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. Grace to you and peace be multiplied. Now turn over to chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they observe glorify God in the day of visitation. What I want to do this morning for the time that we have is to talk about a couple of words. And these are slippery words as far as the translations are concerned. I will use them as they are translated here in the New King James Version in chapter 2 and verse 11. Sojourners and pilgrims. The fact of the matter is, the same word that is translated sojourner in chapter 2 and verse 11 is translated pilgrim in chapter 1 and verse 2, and that doesn't help us out any. So I want you to realize that I'm going to try and establish a distinction between the two terms, translated sojourner and pilgrim, because both of these terms represent kinds of aliens. Now, when I grew up, I didn't even know what an alien was until Buck Rogers came along. And I remember when the episodes of Buck Rogers began to play down at the theaters, and we'd go down for a nickel on Saturday morning and we'd watch the episodes of Buck Rogers, and the aliens began to enter the world. I want you to understand, however, that we live in an age in which aliens are everyday household beings. Not only do we read about them and do we see them on television, but our children are buying them at McDonald's. So the term alien has become much more familiar to us. I want us to understand that there are two basic kinds of aliens, and they are both represented in these terms that are used in 1 Peter. And Peter is kind of telling us who we are as Christians by describing us as aliens, and describing us in the two kinds of aliens that are common and that are familiar. Basically, what Peter is saying is that Christians that are in the world are not at home. That we are in some sense away from home. And that we are away from home really in two different ways. 1 Peter begins with an address, as we read just a moment ago, to the elect pilgrims scattered throughout Asia Minor. And he lists the provinces, five of them, Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. That really is the landmass of what is now Turkey. At least the larger part of the western part of Turkey. And it is what in our Bible atlases is the landmass of Asia Minor. These were some of the most notable provinces of the Roman Empire in the first century A.D. At the period of time that Peter's writing, which is the time that Nero was emperor in the city of Rome, and we'll have something to say about that in a subsequent letter. He says that they are sojourners and pilgrims in the world. They are alienated from the world, and they're suffering for Christ, and that manner of life is common to all of them. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 9. Verses 8 and 9, maybe. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brethren or your brotherhood in the world. All of us, if we truly are Christians, are going to suffer to some extent. It may be nothing more than dropping our heads in the midst of a group of people that are worldly minded. I was told a conversation last night about an individual and his boss, and this person said something to the effect that basically I need some time off so that I can get more involved in my church work. And the boss just kind of looked at him funny. You know, the truth of the matter is we live in such a secularized society, and we live and work among people that are so dedicated to materialism and so dedicated to making money and so dedicated to doing what the job demands and what the company demands that they don't really even comprehend what's involved in being a Christian. Now, what I'm trying to say is that for a split second, that was a form of alienation on the part of this Christian as he saw this strange look on the boss's face. What do you mean you need more time to devote to church work? Because in the boss's mind, the company store owns this man's soul. And for the most part, that's what they think about you. That's what they think about me. And it's no different, even though I preach the gospel. Now, I did teach in secular work for 34 years, and the school thought it owned my soul. And the fact of the matter is, a local church thinks it owns the soul of the preacher. But it doesn't. The Lord owns each of our souls. And our commitment is to the Lord, and our responsibility is to the Lord, and we are aliens insofar as this world is concerned. And we all share together a common bond. Some of us are alienated to a less extent than others, but all of us, if we really come down to the old expression, the licking law, are going to experience that alienation to some extent or another. It may be no more than the judgment we have to use in clicking the channel changer for a television set. That will tell us probably, as realistically as anything else, how accommodated we are to the world or how alienated and estranged we are to the world. Whether we feel comfortable enough to listen to obscene language, to view obscene pictures, to hear our Lord and Savior blasphemed in our living room. That's going to tell us a lot as to whether or not we're strangers and pilgrims or whether or not we have really become so accustomed to or hardened to or just grounded in the world that we do not feel estranged as we ought to. I want you to look with me at the end of the book of 1 Peter, over in chapter 5 and verse 13. We read a statement that matches chapter 1 and verse 2. She who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, and so does Mark my son. Now you'll notice that in verse 2 of 1 Peter, Peter addresses the elect, those who are chosen by God. And then he mentions over in chapter 5 and verse 13, those who are chosen together with you. They are in a bond that ties them together as the elect. You will notice back in chapter 1 and verse 1, they are described as scattered throughout. And in chapter 5 and verse 13, it describes this feminine character, whether it is an individual or whether it's a congregation, is really beside the point, who is in Babylon. I want to suggest to you that there is not an accidental relationship between this idea of scattered throughout in verse 1 of chapter 1 and Babylon of chapter 5 and verse 13, that this is a deliberate repetition of an idea. The word translated scattered throughout is a term which literally means dispersion. It's a technical term. The Jews, as a result of their captivities, especially the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity, were scattered throughout the world of their day and age. There were pockets of Jews, therefore, that continued to exist in various parts of the world right on up to New Testament times. There was a strong colony of Jews in Alexandria, Egypt. There was a strong colony of Jews over in the region of the Euphrates River. There were colonies of Jews in nearly every major metropolitan area of the Roman Empire, including Rome itself. And there were lots of Jews that were in the country of Palestine, in and around especially the city of Jerusalem. But they were scattered throughout the Roman Empire. They were dispersed. Now I want you to think in your mind for just a moment what I believe Peter is attempting to do, and that is to draw an analogy between God's people in the Old Testament who were dispersed throughout the ancient world and Christians who are dispersed throughout their world. Now that was true of the Christians in Peter's day. It's true of Christians today. There is a brotherhood. I have no idea how big it is or how small it is or who composes it, but there is a brotherhood. It's composed of brothers and sisters, and they are all throughout the world. To my amazement, I came in contact with approximately 10,000 brothers and sisters in the Lord in the country of Ethiopia that I didn't even know existed. And I find out that most brethren in the United States don't know that they exist. I have become almost despondent at times over what goes on in the brotherhood. That is, in my foolishness, the brotherhood that I conjure up in my mind, which really comes down to this: the people that I associate with are the people that I say constitute the brotherhood, and therefore whatever happens with the people that I am acquainted with, I just assume is characteristic of the people of God everywhere. Ain't so. And thank God it ain't so. One time Elijah was just despondent, and his pride got in his way. He had fought a battle against the prophets of Baal, and he felt he was losing the battle and that nobody would stand by his side. And he was running from responsibility. I think that's about the only thing you can say about Elijah on this occasion. He was running from responsibility, and he finally got out in an isolated place, thinking that he would escape the problems. And finally, as a result of another series of things that happened, he just said, "Lord," he said, "it's not worth it. I'm the only prophet of God left in Israel. You might as well take my life." Now, I'm going to paraphrase God, which is dangerous, but basically what God answered him was, "Quit feeling sorry for yourself, Elijah. Get up and do what I told you to do. Go anoint Jehu to be king." He said, "I still have 7,000 who have not bowed to Baal." You talk about something that hit him like a thunderbolt. I'm sure it did. In his mind, he was the only faithful man, or maybe the group that he was associated with were the only faithful people in the world, and God tells him, "I have 7,000 who have not bowed to Baal." Believe that today. Believe, if you don't believe anything else, that God has 7,000 saints. They love him. They are doing what is right. And they're going to be saved eternally. I don't know who they are, never will know who they are. I hope that I make the acquaintance of a few of them in my journey through this world, but it may be precious few that I ever come in contact with. But don't ever think that our time is better than any other time. Don't ever think that the people that we know are better than other people. The fact of the matter is, we're not God. We know very little. The range of our associations is pitifully small in relationship to the total population of the world. And there are isolated parts of the world that we will never, ever hear anything about, who have Bibles, and the principle operates that when the seed is sown, it makes Christians. And we need to believe that with all of our heart. We are intimidated by the world at times. And we are scared to death by what goes on among our acquaintances, and we lose sight of the things that are really significant and important. So if what I'm saying is true, we live in Babylon. Oh, not in any literal sense. There have been countless debates. You can buy a dozen commentaries and read the debates about whether Babylon refers to the Babylon on the Euphrates and a colony of Jews that live there, or whether it is a military outpost down in Egypt, or whether it's some kind of cryptic hidden name for Rome. I really have come to believe it's none of those, but it may be all of those. The fact of the matter is, it is Peter's way of saying that Christians are scattered. Christians are dispersed. Christians live in Babylon today. And that carries with it an association that we do need to know and to appreciate. Now share with me some thoughts, if you will, from the book of Jeremiah. Go back with me to Jeremiah, the 29th chapter, for just a moment. I discovered this a few years ago and plugged it into my lesson, and I have benefited from it a great deal. I want you to look with me at verses 5 and 6. This is a letter that Jeremiah writes to the captives in Babylon, just like Peter is addressing individuals whose friends live in Babylon, whose fellow saints live in Babylon. And here's what he says to these Jews who think that any moment the Babylonians are going to be overthrown and they're going to pack up and go back home to Jerusalem. He says this to them: build houses and dwell in them. Plant gardens and eat the fruit of them. Take wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, and multiply there and be not diminished. You're going to be there a long time. Now, he told them 70 years. That's a good 3 generations. You're going to be here a long time. Now, I am not discounting the possibility that the world will come to an end, but theoretically discounting that possibility, plan to be here for a while. Take the advice. You live in Babylon, build your houses, eat your food, get husbands for your daughters, and give your daughters in marriage to husbands. You ever hear any Christian say, "Boy, it's such a bad world. I don't even know if I want to have any children. I don't want them to live in a world like this. All the problems they face." You realize your parents said that about you, and their parents said that about them. C.S. Lewis used the term chronological snobbery. Every generation thinks that it's either better off or worse off than every previous generation. And when we look to the past, we distort it. Nostalgically, we kind of remember the good and not the bad. I remember when the Waltons came on. I was born at the tail end of the Depression, and I remember, the after effects of it before the Second World War rather vividly. My grandparents on my mother's side were tenant farmers. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have running water. They didn't have indoor plumbing. Plowed with a mule. Went to town in a wagon. I got to experience that kind of life, but I was a stranger and a pilgrim when I did. But it's a different life. I'm sure that they thought in terms of the fact that they didn't want to raise kids in this kind of a world. But the fact of the matter is, we're here and we're going to stay a while. And you see, that's really what it means when it says that we are sojourners. We are resident aliens. That's what the term means. This isn't our country, this isn't our home, but we're here, and we're here to stay for a good period of time. In an English dictionary, the word sojourner means to live somewhere temporarily, to stay for a while. And it's that last expression that captures the idea. We are here to stay for a while, but that while is an extended period of time. So, live life to the best. Take advantage of what's here. And realize that it is by interaction with the world that the world is going to be saved. God put us here as salt and light. He didn't put us here to be isolated. To band ourselves together clannishly as a little group of individuals in a ghetto. Now, the only time ghettos form is when the world has totally cut off and alienated a group of people. And all they have is one another. And so they're pushed into a little part of the world, and all they have is each other. We think of Anne Frank and the Jews in Germany and Europe during the Second World War. Now, it may be that someday Christians are pushed into those circumstances, and we have to have the ghetto mentality. But as of now, we are to go out into the world, and we are to do what we can in helping those who are about us. I also want you to read another passage of Scripture, if you will, over in the 32nd chapter of the book of Jeremiah. It almost seems to contradict itself. It's a lengthy passage, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's verses 6 through 44. And in this particular chapter, Jeremiah is commanded by God to go out and to purchase a field in Palestine from his uncle. Well, it's actually probably a cousin of his, Hanamel. Verse 7 says, "Behold, Hanamel, the son of Shallum, your uncle, shall come unto you, saying, Buy you a field that is an Anathoth, for the right of redemption is yours to buy it." And God says, "Buy the field." And why does he tell him really to buy the field? In verse 15 he says, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall you yet again buy in this land." Buy you a house in heaven. Was that plain enough? Buy you a house in heaven. Because you're not going to be here very long. Compared to eternity, it's not that long that your residence will be here on this earth. Now, for some of you, it may not be 24 hours. I'm being realistic. You're taking your lives in your hands when you get out on these interstates. And especially that's true around Atlanta, Georgia. It's a jungle out there. My hat goes off to you. I'm glad folks like you live in Atlanta. That leaves the country open for me. I'm almost a horse and buggy man. We passed through an Amish district of southern Missouri, and I thought, what a wonderful place. Had to honk for a buggy to get out of the way, you know. So I could do 70 miles an hour on one of the streets. The fact of the matter is, we are going to be here a long time, but we're not going to be here very long at all. Sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Unless you believe both of those things, you will not have a true perspective of what it means to be a Christian. Unless you understand that you're going to be here for a long time, but this is not your home. And unless you understand that you're only going to be here a short time, because this is not your home. You're missing something insofar as life is concerned. And that's greatly what this book is about. Resident aliens, those who are sojourners, translated in several versions as strangers, outsiders, newcomers, foreigners, a person not known or familiar to an individual, have several characteristics, and let me quickly give them to you. Number one is they're settled in. This whole thing that Peter is doing is taken from Genesis chapter 24. Go back there for just a minute. In Genesis chapter 24, Sarah dies, and Abraham does not even own a little piece of property on which to bury her. And so the story is related back there. In Genesis 23, I may have said 24 inadvertently, that he goes to the sons of Heth and says in the fourth verse, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Until you and I realize that really, we do not even own so much as a little sliver of land in the world. And that our mentality is such that we are going to live in tents and ready to pack up and move any moment now. We've misunderstood our role as Christians. You know, the Jews observed the Festival of Booths. I sometimes think that that would be a good exercise for all of us as Christians. You know, they kind of reenact to the situation in the wilderness, and they will literally go out in the backyard, and they'll set up a pup tent, and the whole family will go out there, and they'll live in the pup tent for a while. I think it would do us all good as Christians to do that periodically, just go out in the backyard and set up a pup tent and live without the luxuries, no radio, no television, no newspaper, no cook stove, no electricity, and just learn what it means to be a temporary resident, to live in a tent. We've gotten to the point where we almost look down our nose at trailers. We've got to be more permanent than that. Well, I'm not knocking a brick house. But someday a brick house will collapse when the rains come and the winds blow and the floods rage. But there's something to living in a tent that speaks loudly to our relationship to this world. Maybe we ought to do that for our kids. Maybe we ought to leave them a legacy. After all, everything the Jews do is not bad. Not only are they settled in, but without a piece of land, they're mistreated. Read about Acts, the 7th chapter, the 6th verse, the mistreatment that was received by the children of Israel in the land of Egypt. They had to make the bricks. But we're not only resident aliens, we're non-resident aliens. And let me just quickly give you some characteristics of these non-resident aliens, these pilgrims. In the first place, pilgrims are individuals who are just passing through the field. That's what the word literally means in English, coming from the Latin. It is a person who travels about, a wanderer. And pilgrims are individuals who temporarily reside beside somebody else, generally in a motel. It's like travelers or visitors or vacationers. They're away from home. Paul reminds us in Philippians 3:20, our citizenship is in heaven, not here. They're always looking for something, like the people that came to Athens, always looking for something new, something different. We have our cameras out, you know, snapping pictures. And more importantly, they desire something better. And we'll later on read the 11th chapter of Hebrews, parts of it. They walk by faith and not by sight. To put it in Jesus' words, they are in the world, but they are not of the world. So what's Peter's advice to us under those circumstances as strangers and pilgrims? I'm going to summarize it in two simple phrases, and we'll have a lot to say about this as the week goes on. Be good and do good.